most of you that have been coming for the past few weeks, or even really several months at this point, know that I've been doing a series of talks on the core teachings of the Buddha, which are often referred to as the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And tonight I'm going to talk about the first path factor of the Eightfold Path, which is wise view or wise understanding. In particular, I want to focus on talking about an understanding of karma. In Pali Sanskrit, this word is kama, karma. The Buddha said that the Dharma that he awoke to, the path of practice of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, he said is good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it's good in the end. And I like this because I think that even if we're coming for the first time to practice meditation and coming into a Buddhist community to check it out, there's some obvious benefits for a quality of presence, of present time awareness, of practicing being present in our lives and showing up for our lives. I think that we all know that there's an obvious benefit of that. And there's an obvious benefit to these qualities, these ethical quality of non-harming, these qualities of compassion, appreciation, kindness, generosity and service. And before we even come into any formal type of meditation practice or, you know, really even consider ourselves Buddhist, oftentimes there's a certain degree of intimacy with these qualities. We already know these things. You know, I already know compassion, I know empathy, I know service, I know even mindfulness. Just being aware of what's happening while it's happening. The Buddha, you know, actually said that these things, these qualities of the Dharma, are things that are already internal. They're all already here. And he describes the path of awakening or awakening to the Dharma as uncovering an ancient ruin. It's like you kind of stumble through the jungle into an ancient ruin. And it's like an archaeological dig site. So you kind of get out the heavy machinery at times and the toothbrushes at times, you start to uncover what's already available. These qualities of compassion, these qualities of generosity, of service, of clarity of mind. And this is something that I really felt like I could trust about the Dharma, as I felt like what I was being asked to do, and it seems very clear in the early Buddhist discourse, is what we're really being asked to do is to come and see for ourselves. Is to take up a seat and to see if we can practice with some of these qualities. There's a monk who translates a lot of the Buddhist literature, the early texts, named Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he says that liberation is the inevitable fruit of the path and is bound to blossom forth when there is steady and persistent practice. The only requisites for reaching the final goal are two, to start and to continue. And so I like to think that even if we're here in this room together tonight, we've already started, right? And this is kind of more of our commitment to continue. Gaining accountability and some support and being open-minded enough to come in and to sit down, or to being, you know, determined enough to come back week after week, or wherever you're at. The only requisites on the path are to start and to continue. I like to add in, it's a good idea to know which direction you're going into. And so this is the Eightfold Path. This is the kind of the map of the Dharma that's offered. You know, you look at my map, it's not going to look like your map, right? As I create my map, there are certain landscapes and things that I need to look out for that you probably don't care about. Right, and there's certain landscapes if I looked at your map, but this is part of our investigation, this is part of our path of practice, is to look at, you know, and to be curious about what is our spiritual path, what is our, you know, what is it that we're holding in mind? This is a contemplative practice, and contemplative practice means we're holding something in mind. what we're holding in mind is the Dharma. And the Dharma just means the way things are. So it's kind of ambiguous, right? But I think really here what we're talking about is we're holding in mind what causes and creates well-being and happiness in our lives. What actually does. I ask people all the time, I work in the mental health field, and I ask people all the time, what are some of the things that you do to take care of yourself? You know, like, what's your recovery program look like? Or just in general, what are some of the self-care things that you do? What are the things that actually generate and create well-being and happiness in your lives? And they'll tell me, and we can kind of list off, you know, and I like to reflect on this. I think it's a really valuable practice. Like, what are those things that actually contribute to my well-being? And then I'll ask them, why don't we do those things? Why is it then, it baffles me, why don't I do the things that contribute to my ease and well-being? And the Buddha would say is the reason is because we forget. We don't have a wise understanding or view. We don't actually see that if I was to do X, Y, and Z, that it would create and generate happiness and well-being in my life. We forget, and what we tend to do is we tend to get caught up in busyness. We tend to get caught up in comparing or preparing or predicting or competing or fixing or finding something quick to just kind of make it feel a little bit better. You know, and that this is not your fault, it's a part of the survival system. But what he's saying is you can use your mind to realize that we don't actually have to do that stuff as much anymore. That we can start to relate to our experience and relate to the way that we experience discomfort and the ways that we experience ourselves in the world in a different way. Mindfulness, I say this a lot, I really like this and rely on this as a part of my practice. The word mindfulness comes from this Pali Sanskrit word satipatthana, which actually means not mindfulness at all. It means to remember the ground. And so I like this dharma, this path of practice is actually the ground that I'm remembering. I'm trying to wake back up to what I forget the most, which is right here. Right here is my opportunity to practice. We forget and we fall asleep into, and I do all the time, into the places. This is what the Buddha talks about. He says people can't see this ground, meaning this experience here that's available in front of us, because they delight and revel in their place. And just thinking about all the places my mind's been today, and thinking about all the places that I had to prepare, and all the places that, right? And so it's not a morality thing. It's not a like, well, you just are a bad person and have an awful mind, but instead it's an empowerment thing. It's like, no, we can start to live more from the ground. It's just bringing that back into view, into this view. So the practice starts and ends with view in a way. There's no real end, but it's kind of the beginning of the path and the culmination. Because as we start to orient ourselves to our spiritual path of practice, and we start to actually move into it with some clarity and some vision, and we move through our path of practice, what happens is we generate more wisdom, more clarity. You know, our view actually becomes clearer. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, the importance of right view can be gauged from the fact that our perspectives on the crucial issues of our reality and our values have a bearing that goes beyond mere theory and concepts. Our views govern our attitudes, our actions, our whole orientation to existence. Our views might not be clearly formulated in our mind, we might have only a hazy conceptual grasp of our beliefs, but whether formulated or not, expressed or maintained in silence, these views have a far-reaching influence. They structure our perceptions, order our values, crystallized into the ideational framework through which we interpret to ourselves the meaning of our being in the world. What is needed is knowledge of things as they really are, not merely conceptual knowledge, knowledge as an idea, but perceptual knowledge, a knowing which is also a seeing for yourself. This type of seeing develops into wisdom and enables us to grasp things as they are in actuality, directly and immediately, free from the screen of ideas, views, and assumptions our minds ordinarily set up between themselves and the real. And so our views inform how we relate to our world. My view of the world informs the ways that I think, and the ways that I speak, and the ways that I act. And the view, a lot of times, is incredibly inaccurate, or at least too narrow. Right? I mean, I usually have a part of the picture correct, right? But it's very narrow. It's very small. And so the Dharma is really asking us through this practice, through mindfulness, is to become more aware, to frame up more of what we're experiencing. Like it says here, directly and immediately, free from the screen of ideas that we ordinarily set up between ourselves and what we're actually experiencing. And so to approach things in Zen Buddhism, they call this with a beginner's mind, with a new mind. All right, I have my beliefs, I have my opinions. Okay, cool. I can still have those, but what else is here? If those can drop away for a moment, what else is here? So one of the things that we're being asked to orient our view towards is this principle of karma. There are many philosophical discussions of karma, of which the Buddha was not interested in any of them, about what it is and what happens in past lives and what happens in future lives. As a matter of fact, when people asked him about reincarnation, rebirth, 90% of the time he just wouldn't answer them. Because what he was interested in is how are your actions, thoughts, speech, and actions in this life going to contribute to your well-being, are going to contribute to more suffering and stress. In the eyes of most non-Buddhists, or most Westerners for that matter, karma has this function like fate. So there's this kind of linear and deterministic law of cause and effect. And the idea is that there's like a merit bank that you accrue. So you do something bad and it's going to come back to bite you in the ass later on, right? We've heard this before. I don't know if any of y'all have seen, what's that show? My Name is Earl, right? What's that show? That dude's trying to, like, get rid of all of his bad... He believes he's cursed because of all of his past behaviors, and they continue to come back and bite him in the ass, right? And this is our idea a lot of times of karma, which is actually more of a Western... It's more of the framework of legalist ethics, which is basically is like a set of, like, commandments or a set of, like, kind of punishment principles or morality, like right and wrong or good or bad or sinful and righteous, this kind of idea that there's some, divine character that's gonna, you're gonna get yours someday, right? And this was actually even pre... our kind of Western orthodoxy, even predating that, this was the ideology of a lot of the Vedic traditions at the time of the Buddha, and it was something that the Buddha saw as oppressive, and it's something that he took the idea of karma and changed it, because he saw this idea of deterministic cause and effect, because then how do you explain things like poverty? And did that happen to you because you... did something in a past life? And his idea was that karma just means action. Let's just say that first. So karma actually just means action. That's all it means, is that anytime I think or speak or act, these are the three forms of ways that we can act. We can act mentally, we can act verbally, we can act through our direct behavior. And in early Buddhist thought, the momentum of our actions was non-linear and complex. So the idea is that every action, through either thought, speech, or direct action, has an effect and shapes behaviors and conditions, our psychological inclinations or traits. So there's kind of, it shapes, you know, the ways that we think or speak or act, they shape our behavior. They shape our mental behavior, the way that we speak, and the way that we act in the world. So he's saying to kind of be really careful about what we do, because when we do something, it becomes a habit, right? This kind of cause and effect type of situation is more complex than just if X, then Y. For example, people are not in poverty because of their past behaviors. Rather, they're there for a myriad of biological, psychological, and environmental causes and effects that create those conditions. You know, our government system, the ways that we govern our economy, you know, racial dynamics, in part behavior, in part a lot of causes and conditions. But our minds, my mind, we oftentimes, when things are complex, we like to find the one, right? Or we kind of focus on the one thing that really subscribes to our ideology. And the Buddha said that nothing causes more suffering than clinging to fixed views. He said, if there's really one thing that's going to cause you a whole hell of a lot of pain in this life, it's clinging to the idea of this is the way that it is. Right? And so this makes the Dharma, the practice of the Dharma, a really weird thing, because basically he's saying, he said explicitly, don't even cling to what I say. Don't cling to the Dharma. He says, when you know for yourself things to be useful and wholesome and that they generate the effects that lead to your well-being and happiness, you should practice those things. So for the individual, karma acts in multiple feedback loops. And I'll just say this because for some it may be interesting or useful. So the present experience is shaped and is being shaped by both past and present decision and action. So because of the ways that I've thought, spoken, and act in the past, I'm more inclined to think, act, and speak in those ways again. It's conditioning, right? I'm used to doing those things, so I'm more likely to do that again. But we have volition, which means we have an active capacity to let go of certain habit tendencies and or cultivate new habit tendencies. So in mindfulness increases this capacity. This is fucking neuroscience, right? This is what we're finding with neuroplasticity. This is shit that the Buddha was talking about 2,600 years ago. He invented dialectical behavioral therapy. He invented cognitive behavioral therapy. He invented this stuff. And it's all about this thing is like whatever we practice, we become, you know. And so he's basically saying just be really careful what you're practicing and knowing that you have, with mindfulness, more of an opportunity to attune to what's happening and to practice, right? So this is idea. I really like to kind of look at this from a couple different ends. In the most simplest form, I really like Viktor Frankl, who's the founder of Logotherapy and writer of the book Man's Search for Meaning. He talks about this in a quote. He says, between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our responses lies our growth and our freedom. Right? That's kind of the gist of it. Is that through mindfulness, the space can kind of, we can hold the space a little bit more. And we can therefore have more choice in how we choose to respond to situations. So instead of promoting this kind of resigned powerlessness in the law of karma, an early Buddhist notion of karma was focused on the liberating potential of what the mind is doing in every moment. In every moment is we have active potential. You know, every moment we're acting through our mental activity, through our speech, through our action. And so the path of practice, and this is where our view really starts to be important, is as we come to this understanding, we have more of a desire to start to practice some things that work out for us, right? We start to really look into, well, if everything that I'm doing is going to have some type of result, then I really want to be careful about what I'm making up here, right? So there are two themes I want to touch on. One of them is the theme of conditionality or the law of cause and effect. which we've already talked about both of these themes, and the other theme is the theme of personal responsibility, but I want to kind of separate them a little bit and talk about them. In the Dhammapada, which is one of the Buddhist kind of baskets of teachings, it says, all experience is preceded by the mind, ruled by the mind, made of the mind. If you speak or act with a corrupted mind, then suffering follows you, as the wheel of the cart does the track of the ox that pulls it. All experience is preceded by the mind, ruled by the mind, made of the mind. If you speak or act with a calm, bright mind, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. I like looking at this as the developing, you know, the developing of inner resources, that everything that we do has a result, you know. And so when we practice things that, you know, aren't so skillful, not right or wrong, but aren't really skilled in creating and generating ease and well-being, what happens is those things follow us. I like this image, like the wheel of a cart follows the ox that pulls it. Right? And then when we practice qualities of, you know, more skillful qualities of mind, speech, and action, what happens is I like this image of, it's like a shadow that never leaves, right? This inner resource that we have to pull from. And this, as this inner resource develops, we find that and we feel more confident in our ability to relate to the world. We have more faith in the practice and the path itself, and then we keep going. And this is the thing that I see time after time, is that oftentimes when something doesn't pay out the dividends right away, we go to the next thing. You know, and this is what the Buddha calls the perpetual wanderers. Right? I've been a perpetual wanderer a lot of my life, just kind of going around to the next thing that's going to satisfy, or the next thing that's going to do it, or the next. Yeah, but sticking around long enough to develop this, you know, cause and effect, this practice, this inner resource of, yeah, this is actually something that's reliable, that I can have faith in. Cause and effect, looking at cause and effect, another way to put this is in biology they have a term called morphic resonance, and it means that when something occurs in nature, it's exponentially more likely to occur again. So the first time that something ever occurs, once it occurs, it's way more likely to occur another time, right? So it's kind of like a miracle for something to happen once. But once it happens, its likelihood of happening again goes up. Habits are subject to, the idea here is habits are subject to natural selection. The more often they're repeated, the more probable they become. And the Buddha says, whatever one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So this, I like to think about that sometimes, of like just almost checking in every once in a while and being like, is what I'm thinking about, do I want this to be the inclination of my mind? Do I want my mind to be inclined towards this? You know, and then trying to generate a little bit of metta, some kindness, you know, try to... to soften the judgment and gently back down from that, you know, thought. I like to think of this also with judgment and criticism of others, and, you know, this kind of comparing mind and quality. I notice it's interesting that I learned how to relate to people from that place when I was in middle school. That's kind of was what I learned to keep me safe. Is, you know, you've got to find where the target is. I got in a lot of fights in middle school. I had a pretty loud mouth, and so that didn't serve me too well. When I was pre-puberty, and the eighth graders were huge. I went to all-guys school, too. Right, so pretty much every day was a threat was somewhere, right? And so just kind of looking for it and judging and looking for the threat and trying to find my way into the pack because I wasn't so strong at that point, right? So what I could do is I could use my verbal violence, right, to really find my way in, to protect. Because if I could say things that were bad enough about you, or if I could judge you enough or criticize you in a cunning or witty way, in a way that really cut deep, then you wouldn't want to pick on me and you wouldn't want to fight me. And so this quality is very much ingrained in the mind to protect. And now that here I am, you know, 30 years old, sitting around, it's like, this doesn't so much actually serve me anymore now that I'm in a Buddhist community, I'm a social worker, and I'm just trying to, you know, have compassion, and... But still, the mind just is like assassinating, you know, pew, pew, pew. So whatever one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. You know, this other quality that's, of course, interconnected to this cause and effect is personal responsibility. And this is the idea that really the only thing in Buddhism, that Buddhist practice, that really belongs to us are our actions and their results. Beings are the owners of their actions, the heirs of their actions, they spring from their actions and bound to their actions, right? So it's really, you know, after we die, what do we have? We have the momentum of what we've done in our lives, you know, and how that's influenced and spread out, right? That kind of karmic momentum of what we have and how we have engaged with the world, you know, with the people that we've touched and the places that we've been. So the metaphor, you know, for this is like what we're doing is here in this experience, here in the present, we're, you know, we're alive in a karmic field. And I like this idea of looking at this like agriculture. So we've, throughout our lives, we planted seeds. Some of these seeds we planted blindly. We just kind of scattered them and threw them. Some of these seeds we've watered for years and years. Some of these seeds we let die. Right, but you know, here we are in this field, and we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to check in, to pay attention, to see what seeds we're planting, where we want to plant them. We have that forethought, that ability to, you know, have some direction, some instruction, and we can plant the seeds, and then we can water the seeds. We want to make sure and check in, what seeds are we watering? What are we developing? What seeds are we cultivating? And then we get to pick the fruit. And some of us aren't even good at this one, right? Sometimes I plant some really good seeds, but I don't stick around long enough to enjoy the fruit. On to the next seed, on to the next seed. I'm busy trying to make the best field, and meanwhile my crops are dying and they're overgrown, and because I'm not actually tending to what I have here. You know, I'm not actually enjoying it. So you plant the seeds, you water the seeds, you pick the fruit. And we're in this this environment, you know, this environment of what we've created. Yeah. And what by we, I mean not just me personally, I mean like what we've created. You ever stop to think, this has happened to me somewhat recently, is I've been in conflict with someone and they really pissed me off, and the resentment really took root in the mind, which I'm really good at that one, too. And I was really just, like, fixated and really pissed off at this person. And I you know, started to think of, like, I wonder what their field's like. Like, I wonder what, if you actually consider everything that we've been through, each one of us, and we had time, you know, to really see that, would we relate to each other in the same way? Yeah, but we get so caught up in the behaviors, we don't see the what's underneath, the suffering. All the good that some of us have done, we don't see that and get too fixated on parts of the field. You know, you didn't build your fence fast enough, your field's growing into my field, right? We get territorial. We start saying, this is your plot, this is my plot, I'm not sharing. And you're like, you have 1,000 fucking watermelons, you're not going to eat all that. Like, well, I'm going to sit over here and watch them die while you don't have anything to eat. Right? We kind of get this, I get like that. I hate to admit it, but I do. This poverty mentality, there's not enough. No, but it's actually my responsibility. You know, it's my responsibility to, you know, have an impact. Dharma, there's no such thing as, There's this term, I heard my teacher talking about this the other day. This kind of like new thing where people talk about engaged Buddhism. There's no such thing as disengaged Buddhism. Right? There's Buddhism is and has always been engaged. It's always been engaged with our society and culture. It's always been engaged with those who are marginalized, vulnerable, and oppressed. It's always been engaged with breaking identification with there are certain classes that are, you know, because you work hard, this idea that because you work hard that's yours and you should keep it and your family should keep it. It's a fucking delusion. It's painful. But what are you going to do with all that fucking money when you die? You know, it's something to do, I guess, to work, and to status, and collect, and get, and then you fucking die. You know, what are we going to do? What's the impact? You know, what's the reach that we can have? You know, beyond just material resources, but with our time, with our attention, lending an ear. So I like looking at this as, this is the last thing I'll share, but I like looking at this as like you can kind of tend your field in a couple ways. You know, one of these is in the form of renunciation. So this is, what are the views, the mental obsessions, the behaviors that are getting in the way of your well-being? If you decide to let some of these go, what will you need to make it happen? And so first thing is to be honest about the ways that we are suffering. Because I'm always suffering. I don't know about you all, but I always am suffering about something. The problem is that I don't know that I'm suffering about something some of the time. Right? And so to just be honest, and suffering is a big word. Stress, right? Obsession, fixation, whatever you want to call it. But this kind of disjointedness or that sense of, gotta get. You know, that kind of... So to be honest and then to acknowledge, if we let these go, if we let these views, these mental obsessions, these behaviors go, you know, whatever the purpose that these behaviors or views served will leave us exposed. So we use things and we kind of go to things because they serve a purpose. Not because you're bad or right or wrong, it's because they work. You know, like me, I use drugs and alcohol, you know, my whole life growing up because it actually worked really fucking well. It made me feel really good, and it made me not have to feel really bad. Right? And so it serves a purpose, but then if you realize and right, we start to be honest about the ways that we're developing suffering in our lives and the lives of others, and we start to actually bring that into our field of awareness, and we decide to let that go, what happens is there's going to be that kind of rawness. There's going to be the dukkha, or the vulnerable experience of what are we going to do with that then? And that's why we don't want to let it go, is because then I'll have to actually feel fucking lonely. Then I'll have to actually feel, you know, separate from, or I'll have to feel anxious or afraid. And so what do we do with that? So what would we need to let go? What would we need to let go of some of these things? We need to then practice. So this is the other part, renunciation, letting go. And then there's cultivation. We want to develop something in its place. What type of support would you need to develop? What are the mental attitudes? What are the intentions or behaviors you'd like to develop? If we decide to make these changes, what would we need to make this happen? This is why people come here. You know, this is why I came here, is because I wanted something. All right, if I'm going to have to stop using crack cocaine and methamphetamine, I'm going to have to do something else, I guess. Right? And so I came here, right? I said, all right, these people, they're, you know, I need some support. I need something in place of. I need something to practice with. I need some, you know, encouragement. I underestimate this all the time. We need other people. We're not going to awaken. We're not going to it's not possible, you know. I don't know. I think about these hermits that live in caves and they're supposedly like awake. And this, sometimes in Zen Buddhism, they talk about these like cave hermits that haven't seen people for years, fully awake. But then they meet someone, right? Someone always walks up on them, and they're weird. You can't. They can't even do anything, right? So we need, you know, we need support and we need other people. So this is a lot, you know, but this is a core principle, and this is the principle, one of the principles we want to keep in mind is that we do have a responsibility. We have a responsibility because whatever ways we think, speak, and act, that has some effect. That has some effect on ourselves, and that has some effect on others. So to be careful about the ways that we think, speak, and act, to develop some accountability with the ways that we think, speak, and act, to practice letting go of some of the behavior, some of the attitudes and the views that cause us harm in the ways that we think, speak, and act, and to develop and cultivate some ground, right? You know, some path. So this is what I wanted to offer for reflection, and we like to open it up to hear other people's, you know, discussion or questions, comments, and we have plenty of time, so feel free, everyone's an expert of their own experience.